Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Blue Half Podcast, Episode 3, Doesn't Time Fly? My name is Roger Armstrong. Thanks for listening. And if you were listening last week, you'll remember that we had apologies from Jim Keogan. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined for the first part of this third episode by Jim. Jim, good afternoon.
Hiya, you're right?
Very well, thank you, Jim. Now, I'd like to talk about a number of things with you, but first of all, you are a renowned Everton author, and tell us a little bit about a couple of the books that you've written. I particularly like the one about the 90s, so tell us about your written stuff, can you?
Well the one on the 90s was Highs, Lows and Bakayoko's, which sort of tried to understand what happened to the club during that period, kind of going into it as an elite club and then leaving it as kind of the modern version of Everton that we know. And the other book was Everton's Greatest Games, which kind of picked out 50 key games from the club's long history. Some of them, winning titles, winning cups, but some just key emotional games that took place, like Wimbledon, Coventry, yeah. Games like that as well.
Yeah, the 90s was some decade, wasn't it? I remember it well. I think I was, must have had a season ticket there for four or five of those seasons. And,
yeah.
You know, that one of my most vivid memories of Goodison. I mean, a lot of people will talk about Bayern Munich in the 80s and some of the other fantastic games, the trophy winning teams and victories. Yes, this was a victory, but I think my abiding memory of Goodison from that decade would be the absolute silence when Wimbledon went 2-0 up.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's nothing like it, really. It's that sense of just all hope gone. And yeah. I think a lot of people have gone into that game thinking, oh, we're too good to go down, maybe, and thinking that we had a chance. I can recall it being a really bright spring day.
There was a
sense of kind of novelty to what was going on. I think a lot of people thought, oh, we'll probably be okay, even though, you know, if you look at the table, we were in, you know, a terrible position. I think when it was 2-0, and, you know, on the back of weeks of gutless displays when that team just could not get a win, or score three goals, you're thinking, well, that's it. We're obviously done. It's a moment that really sticks with you, because I mean, to see Goodison like that, completely silent and just kind of like all hope being sucked out of it. It was a really strange time.
The life had gone out of the place. Remind me, because, you know, I've talked about this with mates years and years afterwards, and you know, you could think about that game as a bit, was it fixed in some way, shape or form? And actually, was there not a ridiculous handball for Limpar? Was that for their first goal or their second goal?
The first goal was, a stupid handball by Limpar. I think a corner came in and he went for the head there, wasn't getting close to it, stuck his hand out, and then they converted the penalty. And then the second goal was like a comedy of errors. I think the ball came in, our centre-halves collided, I think.
Right.
It fell to one of their players. They kind of mishit their shot. It was going wide. And then it hit Gary Ablett, who steered it into the net. So you're thinking, yeah, not only are we 2-0 down, but we've effectively given Wimbledon two goals as well. It was the most Everton ways to start that game.
And we got one back very quickly, as I recall.
Yeah, well, I mean, Limpar went from...
Villain to hero.
Yeah, and I interviewed him for the book, and he said he dived. He said that the game needed something. We needed a change before half time, and he got very little contact, and he just, you know, he went down like he'd been shot.
Yeah.
And then 2-1 at half time. You weren't necessarily confident, but you just had that little kind of flicker of hope that, you know, maybe they could get back into this game.
Yeah, and then it was Graeme Stewart and Barry Horn, right?
That's right. Well, the Horn goal was just bizarre, because I mean, we'd come out after the break showing more intent. But still, I mean, I think just before that goal, I think Graeme Stewart had cleared a shot off the line. So, I mean, you know, there was still a lot of danger from Wimbledon. And then the Horn goal, I can recall being up and celebrating it without really comprehending what just happened, because it was such an unlikely goal from such an unlikely source.
Yeah, who needs Cantona when we've got Barry Horn?
Yeah, exactly. And to hit a shot like that in, you know, at that moment in that game, you couldn't really take it in. And then I think once it was 2-2, I think we just felt the third goal would come. You could just, you know, there's a sense of confidence that you don't often get at Goodison. And I think from that moment on, you thought, we're going to win this game. And then Graeme Stewart kind of popped up with a really tame shot that somehow made its way into the back of the net.
It just dribbled in, didn't it? I mean, there were so many elements of that game that you think, crikey, was this written as a, you know, as a film or something? Was this a script for a play? Because it was just bizarre on so many levels.
Well, I was sat behind the goal that went into. I can recall that shot like being hit and thinking, there's no way that's going in. You could see it was so slow, such a dribble of a shot. Again, you couldn't quite understand what happened. How had that gone in, and how are we suddenly 3-2 up in a game that was, you know, maybe 40 minutes earlier was gone.
Yeah, and it was in our own hands, because once we were winning, we were safe. And then it was Sheffield United who went down, didn't they? The Steen brothers scored for Chelsea, I think.
Yeah, well, their bench was confused. I think they were safe, but they thought they weren't. And I think they went. The instruction was go for the win, and they didn't need to. And I think going for the win, they left themselves exposed, and then it was a last minute goal, and they went down instead of us.
And then come on to the Coventry game, but the cup final just reminded me there of Anders Limpar. I mean, the cup final in '95 with Big Joe Royal and all of that, and all together now. I mean, I bored people with this story many, many times, and I think I wrote about it on the Blue Room a few years ago. But we managed to gate crash the players' party at the Royal Lancaster that day after the game. And a couple of my mates were staying in that hotel. We'd come down on the train and they were checking in at, I don't know, 11 o'clock in the morning. And in the bar of the hotel was Peter Johnson and Duncan Ferguson. I kid you not. And Duncan was having a pint of lager. And I went up to him. I said, Duncan, you seem to be, you know, having pint of lager, and he says, I'm only an effing sub. Right? This is true. I'm not making any of this up. I'm not embellishing it at all. Obviously, the game happened. Rideout scored the winner. It was just, what, it was the last trophy, and it was such a great, great moment. And then we got back. We made our way back into central London, and by about 9 o'clock, we managed to blag our way past security guys into the room where the Everton party was. And the first thing that we saw, we were, I don't know, there were four or five of us, and maybe a dozen others had managed to blag it in as well. And the first thing we saw was Anders Limpar in a fireman's lift being carried up to his room by FA Cup winning goal scorer Paul Rideout, because that was apparently the first and maybe the only trophy that Anders Limpar had ever won. And, and he didn't drink. And he'd had a few. Apparently, and he was off to bed. Now, whether that was the first trophy, I don't quite know, because did he not win anything at Arsenal? I thought he would have.
Yeah, you thought so, wouldn't you?
But those were the days. That was the highlight of the 80s, I guess. And then there was the Coventry game where, good God, we were close to relegation then, weren't we? If it hadn't been for Gareth Farrelly, closer arguably than against Wimbledon.
Yeah, I think, and also a very different feel to that game as well. I think, as I said before, I think with the Wimbledon game, there was a novelty value to it. The weather was nice, a feeling that we'd, not just that we'd survive, but also because of Johnson's investment, we thought that if we survived, then the following seasons would be good, because finally we had some money. I think by Coventry, that money had gone. And all the kind of the sense of never again, kind of proven to be hollow. And here we were, a very poor team who probably deserved to go down. One of the worst kind of Everton teams I think I've ever seen. And that sense that even if we did survive, what next? Because Johnson was clearly on his way, unpopular. The money, the kind of the cash tap seemed to be turned off. And it's, even with survival, the future didn't look particularly positive. And I remember that day it was a kind of overcast, and that really captured the mood that the fans were. It wasn't the same euphoric atmosphere after survival. There was a sense of a real feeling of anger amongst the supporters. Happy that we'd survived, obviously, but not that kind of I think after Wimbledon, it was really euphoric. We were so relieved as well. With Coventry, it was different. It was nastier at the end of
it. Was Coventry not the season as well? I mean, Bolton went down, I think, instead of Everton, yeah. Thank God. And was there not some controversy about our game at Bolton? Had they scored one that was over the line that wasn't given, or one of our goals wasn't over the line but was given?
Yeah, I think it was it Nathan Blake? I think it was they'd scored a proper goal. It well crossed the line and it wasn't given. And I know over the course of a season, lots of things can happen. But had they, theoretically got that goal given and won that game rather than I think we drew it, then they would have survived and we would have gone down.
A really, really scary time. So. That's a fascinating book for everyone, Evertonians of all generations, to just see how thin that dividing line is between success and failure and, staying up and in the space of what have we done there? We've gone from avoiding relegation, two seasons winning an FA Cup, and then another two seasons avoiding relegation again. I mean, we ended that decade on the road to nowhere, really. And we've now just started another decade. Terrible segue that. 2020, we can all see more clearly. What's your view of the likely trajectory for Everton Football Club in this decade, Jim? Get your crystal ball out and what are you hoping for? And then what do you expect?
Yeah, I don't know what you expect with Everton. Because, based on recent seasons, you can't predict, can you, what's going to happen? It's just we seem to be in a position where we think everything's in place, everything's sorted, and then it ends up being, so incorrect. I think with this manager, we've got a golden opportunity, I think, right now. This is a chance to kind of get it right. I mean, we've got somebody in charge who, arguably, probably, certainly on his CV, probably our best manager, potentially our best manager ever. He's got, no former Everton manager has a CV like this. So, that's you'd hope that's the right appointment, and now you just got to hope that it works out, and we don't have what we had in past seasons, but we think we've got the right man, and then a few months down the line everything's gone to shit.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, the fact you put a great little quote in when I did ask people for a few little vox pops on me, and you talk about that this. Evertonians embody and I embody this pessimism, this streak of pessimism, you called it. Brilliantly put. What more would you expect from a writer? But pessimism tinged with good humour. But, half of your brain is thinking, how on earth are we going to screw this up? We've got Carlo Ancelotti. We should have a sack full of money. Every club other than the shower over the park are in a real mess. Opportunity knocks galore. Surely we can't mess this up, can we, Jim?
Well, we could, because with Everton Army. But I think you'd hope that. I mean, this is kind of the environment we would have killed for, 6 years ago. Having a manager like this, having an owner with this amount of money, moving to a new stadium potentially, and having the elite of the game in disarray. So, if you think back to when Moyes was in charge and we still had Ken Wright, you couldn't envisage this happening. And now everything is there. Everything we wanted is in place.
The planets are aligned. But you talk about me being pessimistic. You write quite a bit on Grand Old Team, don't you?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Yeah. And I find myself drawn to some of your pieces because you're not necessarily always half full. What do you think of this current squad? Last week I talked to Andy about areas we need strengthening in. But do you think that we might need a bit more? Do you think we're sorted in any area at the moment, from goalkeeper to centre forward to anywhere on the pitch that we couldn't do with some improvement?
It's hard to tell, isn't it? Because I think, this same squad under Silva, people were talking about it being one of the worst Everton teams they'd ever seen. And suddenly, in the space of a few months, there's certain players there now, the same fans who were saying, oh, he's crap, and this lot of crap, and now saying, oh, no, he's fantastic, and look at his form. So I think we'll know more by the end of the season who is working and who isn't working, and the areas that we might need to strengthen. I think one area is probably that I worry the most is the keeper, because it's really important, as Liverpool have shown, if you get the right person in that place, not just in terms of, you know, stopping shots, but also giving his defence confidence. And I think at the moment, if you were a defender, you wouldn't necessarily look at Pickford and he wouldn't instill you with a lot of confidence, because as we proved in the last game, you know, that was an important mistake he made. We were on top and in control, and in the blink of an eye, he makes a stupid mistake and suddenly the character of the game changes. You're thinking, I know keepers will always make mistakes, but he seems particularly error-prone this season. Isn't really improving from when we first bought him. I mean, you'd hope after a few seasons, he starts to mature and you see the growth of the kind of the keeper we hoped he'd become, and that isn't really happening. And that's the one area where I think that needs to be addressed. It doesn't help that he has no competition either, really. So he's going to be in the squad week in, week out. So you possibly have to sign someone to either replace him or to at least give him some competition.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think he is a cause for concern. You want the goalkeeper to be anonymous, apart from making saves that are saving goals, not to be in the news for conceding easy goals or coming out and flapping at things and creating chaos in his own penalty area. I mean, one of the things that really excites me about Ancelotti, not just his track record, and he's already proven that, you know, he can win trophies at different clubs and in different leagues, but already I can see improvement in some of the players. Holgate would be a cracking example. Calvert-Lewin would be a cracking example. But perhaps the most bizarre one for me is Theo Walcott, who is, you know, seems to be playing remarkably well and doing more things right than wrong, acting like a professional right winger, and fits into his plan much more than, you know, he previously did under Silva. So, you know, Ancelotti is making the best of the resources he's got, but it's got to be exciting to think about the signings he might make, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that he is an elite manager, and we've not had that in the past. I mean, our players have tended to have to make do with, you know, Wigan's former manager or Watford's former manager. We've not really had the kind of manager that big clubs have, and I mean, they're good for a reason. They get the best out of players. So it's no surprise that he comes along and suddenly these players who've been struggling under Watford's former manager suddenly up their game. But I think you're right, though. I think we will obviously recruit in the summer, and it'll be interesting to see the kind of players that his name can bring to the club.
All right. Jim, to wrap up, because in the rest of the show, we're going to talk to a couple of other Evertonians, Andy and Neil, hopefully, on the subject of being an exiled Evertonian. You know, here's me now down on the south coast in not so sunny Bournemouth today. Where are you based, Jim?
I'm about 6 miles just south of Tunbridge Wells.
Yeah. Okay. So you're also an exile, if you will.
Yeah.
What's it like? What's your relationship with the club, and how is it different now that you're not, you know, in the centre of the city and growing up surrounded? I mean, you probably got loads of Copites around you in Kent, what's it like being an Evertonian, 300 miles away from the city?
That's the weird thing. You're not surrounded by Reds in the same way that you are in Liverpool, but equally you're off in the blue alone. So where I live, I play five-a-side on a Thursday night, and there's like 10 dads from the village who play there. Six of them are Reds. So I still have that kind of horrible relationship with the Liverpool Football Club, because I'm still surrounded by Liverpool fans. It's not as saturated as it is in Liverpool, but I can't escape it. So it's still there, and it's still slightly jaundiced my view of the game. I still have that weird Liverpool obsession that I had growing up, where I can't get that club out of my mind completely.
Totally. No, I mean, I was watching the cricket yesterday. I was watching Owen Morgan hitting sixes to all parts of the ground, and it was very, very exciting until I saw some fans with Liverpool shirts celebrating. They just get everywhere, don't they?
Yeah.
You can't escape them. If you went to Mars, you'd find a few.
I know. It's like a plague. They are literally everywhere. I mean, in my son's school, he has like about he's the only Evertonian in the school, but in his class alone, in a class alone, there's about seven Reds from about 12 boys. They are everywhere.
Yeah, sad. But, you know, if we can get it right under Carlo and a few quid in from Mr. Usmanov and Mashiri counting the beans nicely and Richarlison banging them in from every corner, maybe next season we'll give them a run for the money. Thanks, Jim. Really appreciate your time today.
No worries. Okay.
Check out Jim's work. Check out Jim's written work on Grand Old Team. Check out his books, Highs, Lows and Bakayoko's, Everton's Greatest Games. And you've got a new one coming out, Jim, which is called...
How to Run a Football Club, which is out in the summer, which looks at English football right from kids starting out in the game, right up the pyramid to the Premier League, and looking at clubs along the way.
All right, check that out, boys and girls. Thank you very much, Jim, and I'll talk to you soon, mate.
Great. Thanks, Dan.
Okay, that was an interesting chat with Jim, and I want to broaden that discussion about what it's like to be an Evertonian but not necessarily be living in the city or the city region. With the next two guys I've got, two Everton stalwarts in the Twitterati, got Andrew and Neil. Good afternoon, gents.
Good afternoon.
Andrew, can I come to you first? I'd like just to give you the opportunity to tell the listeners, introduce yourself, who you are and what your affiliation is with Everton, your Twitter handle and all of that before we get into the meat of the discussion.
Hi everyone. My name's Andrew. You probably know me as Catcher in the Rye off Twitter or the football forums that I write on. My affiliation to the club. Both of my parents are Everton fans. The majority of the extended family support Everton too. My mum and dad moved away from the city just before I was born, so I haven't grown up in the city. But there's obviously quite strong links there through my family. But I grew up in the southeast of the country.
Okay. Thanks, Andy. And Neil, where are you?
Neil is my name. I'm currently living in Athlone, which is smack bang in the middle of Ireland. Grew up in Bootle and Melling. Left home when I was about 20. Never really been back apart from visits. Predominantly Everton family. And yeah, that's it. Still struggling.
Yes. Now, listen, Jim, you didn't catch the conversation, but Jim's down in Kent. He's just outside Royal Tunbridge Wells, and he said he plays five-a-side football once a week, and he's the only blue there, and there are like six Copites in the group, and his kid is the only boy in the school that's an Evertonian. What are your experiences, Neil, in Ireland of both being an Everton fan? Because what Jim said was quite interesting in that it's not just meeting other Everton fans, it's actually still not being able to escape Liverpool fans. What's your experience over in the Republic?
Yeah, that's a cross we definitely have to bear over here, I'm afraid. There's a huge amount of Liverpool fans. Liverpool and United would obviously be the predominantly supported clubs over here. As an Evertonian, there's a few of us knocking around, which is always nice. You do get a little rush of excitement when you meet a fellow blue, or you even spot one in town walking around in an Everton shirt. So, you know, there's a fair number of us, but we are like a sort of quiet majority, if you like, in comparison.
And match time, so you don't go back to Liverpool much, so you don't get to go to many games. So if we're on the telly, what's your match watching pattern? Do you watch it with other blues or do you watch it behind the sofa?
Well, both, really. Predominantly blue family, so I tend to watch it with my brother and my sister and whoever else would be around. If we go into town, you tend to find the pubs would be blues in there, but you wouldn't necessarily meet many Copites on match day if we're on telly.
No, fair enough. Andrew, what's it like for you?
Similar, I think. I mean... When I was growing up, I think I said to you, Roger, before, that the majority of my age group were Manchester United fans, to be honest with you. It was just when Manchester United was starting to be really successful. So Liverpool had a big following, no doubt, but Manchester United were really probably the dominant team. And again, yeah, you don't meet many blues. I mean, there are stories of me as a quite young lad. If I saw a bloke in an Everton shirt as an 8 or 9 year old, I'd almost chase them and want an autograph with them or something, you know. And I remember my dad took me to the 1995 Charity Shield, and I think I irritated him enormously by asking everyone if they supported Everton, because it was overwhelming for me. I'd never seen so many Everton fans somewhere. You support Everton? And I remember my dad saying, look, they all bloody support Everton. Just stop asking them. Everyone is Everton. And that blew my mind as a young man. So, yeah, I mean, what you notice when you meet Everton supporters, I think, is there's a real knowledge and a passion from the majority you meet. You know, the majority are absolute sort of dyed-in-the-wool fans. You can sit and waste an hour talking to them about it. So, yeah, I mean, you don't meet many, but the quality is always very high.
1995, that Charity Shield was against Blackburn Rovers, I think.
It's like Vinnie Samways scored.
I was so excited when we signed Vinnie Samways. I thought he was going to be the second coming, but he ended up playing for Las Palmas or somewhere in Spain, didn't he? He was a total flop.
He did. He was. My dad never liked him. He was a sort of luxury player. He was never quite an Everton player, I don't think. So, but he got the winning goal in the Charity Shield. So
he did.
He did something right.
And Neil, you talked about, you know, family and everything, and that's important. But to what extent do you think, you know, the club plays a little bit to that local audience, and do you think the club does enough to reach out to people beyond Liverpool?
Not at all. The website itself, for example, is ridiculously unfriendly towards users, I find. So you know, you've got an instant access sort of issue there. Then you have the issue with merchandise and kits and availability. The profile of the club isn't massive abroad. There's so many different things that they should really be capitalizing on.
We've got Seamus Coleman, captain of the Irish football team.
Absolutely, yeah.
And accessibility to Everton shirts in shops in Ireland is what?
It's minimal. You'll see a few at the start of the season, maybe. It's got better over the last couple of years, perhaps with the loss of the kit bag deal.
Yeah.
Or the removal of the kit bag deal. But the numbers aren't there. I mean, you go in, you might see one rack with five or six Everton shirts on next to five or six racks with Chelsea shirts, 20 racks with Liverpool shirts. You know, the penetration just isn't there.
Yeah, and so if you see kids playing football in the park or whatever, you don't see Everton shirts there, right?
Not very often, no.
Yeah. I mean, I saw something on Twitter the other day, and we seem to like to do this, and I kind of know why, but, you know, BT Sport were interviewing a few Liverpool fans in a bar in Madrid ahead of the game on Tuesday night, and, you know, we were making fun of the fact that they didn't have Scouse accents. Now, yeah, okay, but, you know, it's a big so what to me, because
surely
we want fans from everywhere. I'm hoping next week to have somebody on from Australia, somebody on from Canada. And, you know, the wide, wonderful world of Twitter shows you that there are Evertonians everywhere. And we said, we've got Seamus, you know, we've had Tim Howard from America, Timmy Cahill from Australia, Stephen Pienaar from South Africa. And we still seem reluctant. I know that they are now global ambassadors and the like. We just seem reluctant, Andrew, to reach out beyond the national boundary, let alone the city boundary. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the club's cultivated its image in opposition to what Liverpool do. So whatever Liverpool do, we try and do the opposite. And I mean, I think if you want to try and build anything successfully, you rarely do that by being different, being the opposite of someone else. You have to try and do what's right for yourselves. I mean, I think the rooting that Everton have in the community in Liverpool is very, very admirable. I think one important point with this is that I think there's a very large, what you may sort of call Scouse diaspora of people, whether two generations ago or their mum and dads have moved away. And I mean, Everton is a very strong connection, I think, that people carry with them. And so you've got people who, while they might not live in the city, they've got still a strong affinity to the city and a really strong affinity to the club. And yeah, I mean, you can't help but say that even just visiting Goodison Park compared to visiting Anfield or Old Trafford or the Emirates Stadium doesn't feel markedly different. You know, we feel probably 20 years behind in terms of our outlook. And yeah, I mean, it is probably something that needs to be challenged, because it's not the origins of the club, Roger. You know, it's not the origins with which the club was built on when it was first formed or through the pre-war years. It's kind of slipped in, I think, as a product of defeat that we've had over a period of time, and probably needs to be challenged a little bit.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't like to use the word, but there's a certain level of hypocrisy, if you like, in regards to how we look at other clubs' fans who aren't from, without naming any club in particular, who aren't from that region in comparison with our own. And, you know, there was an example there on Twitter. Again, I won't mention any names. There was a guy who interacted with a Scouse Everton fan in a really positive way. And, you know, that went down a storm and everyone was saying how great that was. But if you see, you know, this guy who's from a different country is getting treated as, you know, the exact opposite how we treat another club's fan from another country.
Yeah, I think it's really deep, this. And I agree with you, Andrew, that it's not been around that long. It's kind of only come out since we stopped winning things. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of been, it's been the legacy of this Bill Kenwright era, if you will. And yet we've had, as most clubs have had, a far greater range and array of international players and international exposure with the advent of the Premier League. And we've just hidden away from it. And what we're doing now, which I think is positive, I think using those former players and trying to get out there and making a broader appeal, which we never did when, for example, we had Chang, you know, I mean, we could have made so much more out of that. But we seem to still be doing it under sufferance and almost as an afterthought, that we just, you know, we're far more comfortable talking about the people's place, talking about the people's club, talking about what we do, Everton in the community, which is hugely admirable. We all know that. But to compete and to be a successful business, we need to reach out and find people to become new supporters, not just, you know, I mean, actually, it's a terrible time to be a Blue because the Reds are doing so well. So actually, the local market is probably just going to be even more saturated with Reds because they're winning trophies. Give me some examples of what you think we could do more of, or we could do better, Neil. So, you know, there you are in Ireland. How could we interact with you guys more?
Well, I mean, for me, I mean, the Premier League's a massive brand globally, and Everton haven't capitalised on that. This, I mean, again, going back to Everton and the community, which, you know, there's no reason that I can see. Obviously, you have to take into account logistics and everything, but you could work through that and make Everton and the community a global thing. Yep. You know, as a foot in to whichever areas, whichever marketplace you want to sort of, you know, stake a claim.
You know, I think that's a fantastic point. Neil, I think that's fantastic, because one of the really key messages that's come out from Everton in the community in the last 2 or 3 years has been about mental health awareness.
Yeah.
And that is such a hot topic, rightly so, nowadays, that, you know, the community aspect, great, of course it is, supporting the local community and being there and providing a sense of togetherness for people in a time of in difficult times particularly, but the broader mental health issues that, you know, the FA have really tried to capitalize on, the Heads Up campaign, you know, Everton could have been really leading that, and leading it not just on a local scale but nationally and even internationally, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a sort of big problem with particularly male suicides in Ireland. You know, there's a very high percentage of sort of 20 to 30 year old men who obviously are suffering from mental health issues. These sort of things that Everton do so well at home, it would be, you know, not beyond the world's possibility for me for them to do it elsewhere and, you know, introduce the club. You could say it's quite cynical in one respect, that you're kind of using someone's mental health as a way to sort of ingratiate yourself. But the positives surely outweigh the negatives as far as that goes.
Yeah, I think you'd have to be pretty cynical to call it cynical if that doesn't sound too obtuse. But, you know, in this day and age, and you know, talking people about being kind and being, considerate, being thoughtful, we've been doing that for some time. And that is how you build a brand. That is how you attract new followers. That is how you appeal into markets that previously, hadn't even thought of Everton or heard of Everton. I mean, if you tell people nowadays you're an Everton fan, what do people say, Andrew? What's their image of Everton, do you think?
I think, and for a lot of people, they probably see the club as just a mediocre middle of the table Premier League team, Roger, to be honest. I mean, we don't talk enough about our history, I don't think, and not just the league titles and the FA Cups that we've won, but the unique first that we've had. I mean, most people don't seem to know that Goodison Park was the ground that was nominated to hold a World Cup semi-final. You know, people are unaware that, you know, Everton have held the top division title for as long as anyone, or the stories of Dixie Dean or Tommy Lawton playing together. I mean, I don't think that we are forward enough in telling a lot of the stories. If you look at Manchester United and their museum, arguably England's most successful football club, there's still a large amount of sections in there for stories that are involved in it, you know, and we've got lots of them. You know, there's lots of very quirky stories that we could engage with people on. So I can't blame them for that. You know, it's a byproduct, I think, of people within the club just not wanting to push that story outwards, I suppose. But
I mean, Andrew, for me, the irony of that is there's nobody loves a story more than Bill Kenwright.
You're right.
And the fact that we've never taken advantage of the fact that, like, Dixie Dean did what he did. Yeah. I mean, there was BT did a big documentary on Jimmy Greaves there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about him being England's greatest goal scorer, and it's like, well, he's not, lads. You know, at the end of the day, he was great, but he's not England's greatest goal scorer.
I've seen, like, England teams mentioned, and Dixie Dean doesn't get a mention, and Tommy Lawton doesn't get a mention either. You know, Tommy Lawton scored, I think he scored 40 league goals as a 19-year-old before World War II. I mean, it's an incredible story, actually. And I think people in the world are really interested in them now. You know, you look at the different documentaries that there are on Netflix. I mean, there's plenty of unique instances with Everton that we could really put out there. But for whatever reason, we're just a bit too cautious. And you're right, but Bill Kenwright's an excellent storyteller. But for whatever reason, maybe we don't do that well enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to hear you both talk about the history. And Andrew, when you said you think that we don't make enough of our history, it kind of made me jump a little bit, because I think we overdo it. I mean, I'm proud of it. I'm proud of the fact that we got 9 league titles and all of that, and not many people know about it, but you don't win cups with history. And I think we've relied on it for way too long. And I think it's been this comfort blanket. And you add that to the comfort blanket of the charity and the community. And actually, we're all very happy because actually we're not Liverpool. And that seems to me desperately unambitious and very short-sighted.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, Roger, Everton first and foremost is a football club.
Yeah.
You know, the best thing to do is get known for your football.
Sorry,
you'd have thought so, wouldn't you?
That's all right.
Go on, Andrew. Sorry, you were going to come in there.
I was just going to ask, I mean, on the history point, do you think we hold people to the history enough? I mean, I know we talk about the history a lot, but I think in quite an abstract way that doesn't connect to the present. But do you think that through the club there are enough people holding people to the standards that went before? I mean, that would be my question on it. I mean, it's not about talking necessarily about the history, but also holding people to it.
Well, I don't think we do, no. And the clubs that I look to, really, and the clubs that I admire, I think there are probably 3 clubs that I admire outside of Everton, and they would be Glasgow Celtic, they would be Manchester United, and they would be Real Madrid. And I don't think any of those three clubs for any period of time has been, you know, without a really clear identity and a passion. I know United went years without titles, and obviously Liverpool surpassed them, and they had some, you know, they got relegated and all of that malarkey. But, and Celtic have had some dark times, and Real Madrid, you know, were in the shadow of Barcelona for a little while. But ultimately, it comes back to what they're about, which is a combination of history and using that history to influence the present and then the future. And we're too busy looking backwards, and we don't spend enough time looking forwards. What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I'm ambivalent about the whole using the history thing. I mean, I'm very proud of it, don't get me wrong. But again, the dual standards come in when you start like saying to Liverpool fans, haven't won a title for 30 years, ha ha ha. And then, you know, well, what have we won?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah, and yeah. I mean, it even boils down to me. I mean, I love the song, but If You Know Your History, for me, is just the wrong message to be sending out at every game. You know, if we don't care what the red side say, as the song says, why the hell are we playing that song? You know what I mean?
No, I do.
Again, there's mixed messages coming out from the club on every level in a lot of respects.
Yeah, and I think there's a bit of confusion. You know, in the last week or 10 days, we've seen this. Okay, we've got rid of Sport Pacer and we're going to have a new shirt manufacturer. And here's all the details of Bramley Moore, and Angry Birds are disappearing. And it's almost like somebody's given us, you know, a shot of something. We've done all of these things all at once. And they are positive. I just hope that we can see them through and we can sustain them. So listen, we've talked quite a bit about history. We've talked about being exiles and, you know, away from the city and how it's different when you're in Ireland or down in the South Coast, away from Liverpool. Just let me get a quick few thoughts from each of you in terms of what the rest of this season holds. We've got four massive games, and the way I see it, we can finish anywhere between 5th and 12th or 13th. What happens in the next three or four games, Arsenal, United, Chelsea, and then the league champions in waiting. What are your thoughts? Andrew, come to you first about where we'll end up and what that means for the summer and the future.
Yeah, I think it's a really pivotal moment, Roger. I mean, we've got ourselves into good positions before, I think, over the last 10 years. And I think on each one, there's this acute sense that we just haven't taken advantage of that. You know, you think of Kerman's first season and the defeat at Anfield, which was really damaging, or David Moyes in the semi-final against Liverpool or against Wigan, where we missed opportunities. I think we're going to learn a lot about this set of players over the next 4 weeks. We're going to learn if they can go on a journey with Ancelotti, or whether we need more change and more transformation come the summer. I'm quietly confident. I actually even think, Roger, that fourth isn't out of the question. I think Chelsea have got 14 points from the last 13 games and are just going in mud at the moment. They're going through treacle. So anything's possible. In my head would say that I think we probably finish 7th or 8th. But do you know what? If we keep, but we're the second best team since Marco Silva left. And we only have to sustain anything near that, and I think we've got a really good chance of being 4th, 5th, 6th in the league. And that message, you hope, is what's being drummed into the players at the moment, that we've probably got an opportunity that maybe we don't deserve, but, you know, you've got to take them when they come.
Oh, I mean, exactly. We had this chat with Jim towards the end of the conversation in that, you know, you couldn't wish for a better time where arguably any club other than Liverpool and Leicester, perhaps, and Sheffield United, are a total shambles, and certainly underperforming. And so whether that's Manchester United, Chelsea, Arsenal, or even Manchester City, Tottenham, you know, we have such an opportunity. It's a question of whether we can push the door open, Neil, and walk through it. What do you think?
Yeah, I'd like to think we can. For me, the biggest thing for me now since Silva left is the attitude of the players seems to have shifted since Ferguson took over. He instilled, obviously, that sort of fight in them. Ancelotti seems to have tempered that with a bit more tactical nous. Everton, for the last sort of 5 years, 6 years, have had this sort of Martinez mentality. You know, the sideways passing, the lackadaisical tackling. That seems to have been erased somewhat. Hopefully that'll continue. And if it does, then yeah, I mean, I'd agree with Andrew and yourself. Certainly, I'd be disappointed at this stage if we finish below seventh.
Yeah, I must just tell you that the Gavin Buckland board's gone up, and this week there's only one added minute. Okay? So carry on with your point there.
Yeah, I would just say that, like, certainly I'd be disappointed if we finished seventh, obviously hoping for better. But if we didn't finish seventh, I'd be sort of think it'd be a shame. However, I would say that Ancelotti is in a unique position to have pretty much a six-month pre-season to get us ready for next year's bout.
Yeah. Andrew, final thought?
Yeah, just on that last point, I think that's a really important point with this, that if we do end up finishing 8th, 9th, 10th, very disappointing, but in the broader sense, it will have still been a terrific turnaround from where we were. And I think Leicester are the ones to look at, where Rodgers had that prolonged period to look at the players and have almost a prolonged pre-season. And our ambition should really be to try and be where Leicester are this time next year and to utilise that opportunity in the same way Leicester have. And that, in many ways, is going to be as important as how we finish this season, how we go into next.
Yeah, well, hopefully we can get some signings in. Hopefully we can be ready, you know, and Ancelotti spends the rest of this season just deciding who to keep and where to replace. I'm optimistic, which is really dangerous because I'm one of the most pessimistic players on the planet. So
I hope that kills you, Rog.
That's terrible, mate. It really is. Yep. Both of you, Andrew, Neil, thank you very much indeed for your time. Thanks to everyone for listening again. Audience is growing and really overwhelmed with the listener numbers. Thank you very much indeed. As I mentioned briefly earlier, next week I'm hoping to talk to Evertonians from Canada and Australia, amongst others, just to re-emphasise that point of the global reach of this football club. And if we really want to go on to the next level, we have to capitalise on those values, combination of history, tradition, but ambition, and aspire to doing better than we've done for some considerable time. I'm going to leave you with a piece of music from the Pogues, which I hope will need no further explanation. Until the next time, come on, you Blues.
It's not the leaving of Liverpool.